Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
Oh, there we go. January 26, 2023, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the show you are looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. Anyway, it's Thor's Day, and Mike Swanson will not be joining us this week as was scheduled. He had something come up, but that's all right. You know why? Because my planned guest that I would have brought on in the next hour has agreed to join me right away so that we could continue the discussion from last week regarding the Cold War 2.0. I don't even know how to frame this, actually. There's a title for it, and I think it's going to develop organically. Last time I had Larry Hancock on, the great author Larry Hancock, we already been through this. If you don't know, I've done at least a show in recent times on every single one of his books. There are many. I may actually add him to the O'Shelly.com deck of cards. Anyway, I'll talk about that in the second hour. That's something coming up. But we're privileged to have Larry with us, the author of In Denial, the author of Creating Chaos. These are very relevant things for what we're discussing today. But, of course, someone would have talked. Nexus, I mean, on and on. Unidentified. Anyway, we'll get there. We'll talk to Larry. Really quickly, though, interesting context. What are we talking about in today's headlines that has to do with this? We got stuck on the Ukraine discussion last time. Not because I didn't want to go there, but because there is just so much to deal with regarding this relationship with the former Soviet Union, now the alleged Russian Federation, and the rest of the world, okay, we got stuck on the current event regarding Ukraine. So, you know, today, the discussion's about the, what are they calling them? Oh, right, the German tanks, they call them Leopards. I don't have all the technical specs on this, but those tanks, the Challengers from the UK, the obvious introduction of the Abrams tanks coming up, that's in the near future. That's been discussed now, but there is a whole lot more going on than just Ukraine. And what about this concept? And we did touch last time on the issues of what NATO encroachment. Is that the phrase they use? I think it is. And exactly what's going on. I mean, is Putin a progressive thinker? Is he a world leader who has a great deal of control over his own nation? How do we view it? Some people have made him a hero. Some people made him a great contrast to the American leadership. Over the past few years, he definitely had a full-on propaganda program running 24/7 in English called Russia Today. But he's also had a lot more allies and others flanking him over recent times regarding the grand narrative, not just about Ukraine, but about the past, the present, and who knows what the future holds. So anyway, going back to the discussion that we had to end last week because it took a whole hour, and I'm sorry, Larry, I just took up three and a half minutes, trying to recap a little bit here. Do you recall exactly where we left off on this discussion, Larry? And again, larry-hancock.com, obviously you can get his books through Amazon. I'll give you other links to specific books and all that, and maybe a few past shows in the show notes, along with articles that are relevant to what we're discussing today. Larry, first, though, before we go to anything, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, Chuck.
Hmm.
Just ready for spring anytime now, as I normally say. Like, as soon as New Year's Eve, I'm looking forward to spring. Don't like cold weather.
Right. Wet and cold where I'm sitting, but, your experience may vary out there. And where Larry lives, I mean, We're so glad that your internet works better, but it seems as though you're not as close to civilization as I am, and you might be thankful about that, being in the state of Georgia today, a bit of tension in our major city, Atlanta, and all that. But anyway, that's not the topic of tonight's discussion. We might go there in a future show, because we can discuss a lot of things with Larry Hancock. Anyway, sorry, Larry, I digressed there. Waiting for the weather to change and all of that, and I hear you, and of course we'll keep track of your projects, because we're going to have to talk about UAPs and everything in the coming months as you regularly appear back on the show. Anyway, enough out of me. Do you know where we should pick up on this subject?
I think where we left off last time was the challenge of something you just mentioned. Is we may not have an exact name for it yet. It's evolved, whether you want to call it Cold War II or, but we're wrestling with the chronology of how this came about. You know, is this a lot of people that are just looking at the headlines would think that this confrontation with the Russian Federation was a relatively new thing. And I think one of the things I had started pointing out is it's been much slower than that. It actually, you can trace the beginnings of it back to the early 90s inside Russia when actually the Russian presidency began to reform elements of the Soviet administration, if you will. I mean, there were a few years there where Russia was a very open society and looked very democratic and looked very Western. But, for example, in 1992, they actually reinstituted a security service called the FSB. Ministry of Security was redesignated and became the Federal Security Service, which laid the groundwork for reforming the KGB, as it were. A few years later, they reconstituted other elements of their intelligence and active measures organization, which they referred to as the SVR. A lot of things happened during the first decade of this century as they moved back into more of a Soviet model. It's hard to tell at first because they did have a free press and quite a free press. There was a lot of internal criticism, but in the background, what was really happening, and I think the start of it all, is they were dealing with terrorism, as we all were at that point in time. They were dealing with some restiveness in some of the former Soviet republics who really wanted to be independent, like Chechnya. And then that just kept escalating, and gradually, I think the key that you might term as the restart of the Cold War was in 1992, when the KGB was formally redesignated as the SVR and was authorized to start performing active measures again. And you and I talked about active measures and what that really means. That means that you're going to start doing things that are pretty much considered illegal against targeted adversaries, other governments, basically. So that was kind of a critical date in which Russia started looking outwards again. It had been looking inwards for several years after the Soviet collapse, and then it started looking outwards, first to the nations, the former republics right around it, and eventually started applying active measures just further and further out into Western Europe. So there might have been, as we talked last time, there might have been pressure being felt coming from investments and, from European and American investments and democracy initiatives and from NATO, but the pushback really did start, was well underway by the late 90s.
See, now, this provokes me to ask an interesting question, because the way this looked from the outsider perspective is one thing, but then the people that are within the nation when it's in a transition like this may indeed have a very different sort of view on it than those observing it from the outside. I mean, that's kind of obvious, I know, but is this just a simple pragmatic transition, like they had to try to get their own house in order the way it looks and then move on to, okay, now that we have that running to our satisfaction, it's time to turn to international concerns? Or was this more of an organic situation due to the fact that they had just endured that time when we talked about it last time, where there was opportunism, there was the outside, brand initiatives, if you will, the business end of it, where we saw the Western brands being introduced into the culture, into the, well, into the place geographically, directly. Is this more about the psychology of the nation internally, or is this just a matter of fact, this is what you do once you have your own house in order? Now you can start dealing with the others elsewhere, the outsiders, if you will.
I think that's a great question, and I think it's the latter, Chuck.
Okay.
Once they begin getting over some of their economic turmoil, once they did deal with some of the terrorist attacks that were being conducted inside Russia, which really were the genesis for a lot of the elevated security measures. I mean, once they dealt with those, it's like, well, okay, now we have money, we've kind of redone ourselves, we're addressing our immediate, you know, threats that have been around us, like Chechnya, and they reactivated the KGB network, and you have to realize the KGB were far more than spies. Mm-hmm. They were really a political intelligence service, and had really, to a large extent, the KGB allowed Moscow to be in control of the Soviet regimes, the Soviet Union regimes, the nations around them. The watchword was always that, you know, Ukraine may select a leader, Georgia may select a leader, but the selection is approved in Moscow, and the selections were approved through the KGB conduit. So these KGB guys, very experienced guys, were out there with those kind of political and power connections in all those places. So it kind of, that part you might consider was organic. It was what they were used to doing, and so once they were back into a position where they had some funds and they had some authority, they just sort of was back to business as usual. And
right.
I think you could say that it was business as usual during most of the second decade, when they started moving against Georgia and Moldavia and Belarus and Ukraine to kind of reestablish their political authority. That was business as usual. That's the way it had always been done. So, you know, the locals might not have liked it, but the people that were put in power and stayed in power, to a large extent, had been in power under the Soviet system. So it wasn't that new. When you had what were referred to as the color revolutions in some of those countries I just mentioned, it was kind of a local effort to get the old KGB-connected guys out of power. And sometimes it worked, and sometimes it worked. And then, as in Georgia, the Russian Federation stepped in and turned to more aggressive measures, such as military measures against Georgia. So, long-winded answer to say, first, once they had restored their economy and the institutions, then it became organic and just kind of like back to the model that had been in place. And many of the same people that had been in place under the Soviet system. I mean, when we're talking about Putin, you know, these are not newcomers. These are part of the old school.
Right, but it's informative to observe that there is a big difference between the relationship, say, that was had with, let's go to a couple of very key points that, or a couple of very key geographic locations that were essential, it seems to me, maybe I'm wrong about this, but were essential in the KGB infrastructure under the Soviet Union organization. And the reason for this, of course, is that they're very prominent in today's current actions, okay, as the spheres of influence are being struggled over. And that is, Belarus, or Belarus, however you wish to pronounce it. I've always said Belarus. This was a key geographic location to the intelligence structure overall for the Soviets. And so was the Ukraine, right? So both of these regions were keys. And, you know, because people have brought up, well, the one last grand dictator, or the one last significant dictator, is the guy who runs Belarus, whose name is eluding me at the moment. But at the same time, you have the old arrangement almost coming back in, too, so that that guy can maintain his dictatorship. But you had a big difference between that and what happened in Ukraine, and they are neighbors geographically. So there's a geographic element to this, and then there's the reestablishment of access, I guess, full access, not, you know, not like they ever, I don't think, lost access to these regions geographically, etc., but they sort of lost full access to be able to utilize them as they had under the older Soviet organization, right? So this is why we're dealing with this now, I think, because it's still very, very key. It could be, especially if you're under the impression that a guy like Putin wants to reestablish, if you will, the homogenous nature, not necessarily the order, but the homogenous nature of the geographic regions that were had under the Soviet order. And some people have even said, previous to that, just the Russian, what was it called? A kingdom or whatever it was, you know, before that, right? The homogenous nature by which all of these other republics, these other states now, some of them have gone independent, etc., and there's been these struggles. Maybe he's seeking to have an organization similar to that which preceded the Soviet arrangement. But this is a key thing in understanding what we're looking at today, is it not?
It is, and I think we really got an interesting insight into how Putin views it, and it is a very, it's kind of imperial goals overlaid over nationalism, because there was an article that was actually published inside Russia the day after the invasion of Ukraine started.
Mm-hmm.
And the article was really, the wording used in the article was, well, you know, we expect within, you know, this week we will see the Ukraine rejoining Russia. It will either rejoin Russia as part of our military alliance, or it will rejoin as part of a Russian Union state, as Belarus is. And that was a real giveaway. It's sort of like Russian Union, Soviet Union. This is, it's still a union of Russian-speaking peoples. It's still going to be a union that's directed out of Moscow. But it just taking away the political connotation of Soviet Union and translating it to Russian Union tells you pretty much that this is just a replacement. You know, now it's not a political concept. It is a nationalistic concept. And that was a giveaway. Interestingly, that article was actually published, immediately withdrawn from the Russian press, and survived only on the Internet, which is kind of fun, because clearly it had been written to announce that Kiev had been taken and Moscow's puppets were totally in control of the Ukraine.
Right, but unfortunately for them, seems as though the plan did not hold exactly according to plan, right? So,
the next step, so all of that played out. I think, I don't know what word you want to use, but literally the concept that played out was Moscow was going to be pulling the strings politically in most of its former territories. That was under the Soviet Union. That was clearly the goal. And the KGB was really given those marching orders when it was allowed to start using active measures again, because active measures are intended to achieve political control and extend from blackmail all the way to assassination. And we actually, you know, there's no doubt that started happening with a reinvigorated Russian intelligence service that was outward looking. But that started going off, you know, low profile. That doesn't get a lot of news coverage. If interestingly enough, it did inside Russia. Much of what I used as source material for creating chaos was from the Russian press, Russian investigative journalists. They had some extremely aggressive and very effective investigative journalism within Russia for a few years while this was happening, and they were writing about it because it wasn't, you know, there was a lot of opposition to it. It wasn't until Putin actually came up with the brilliant idea of having his oligarch buddies literally buy up, you know, this is capitalism at its best, buy up all the Russian media and literally just fire these guys, that those articles stopped. But for a period of time, there was a real good insight inside the Russian press is, like the KGB has reappeared again in Kazakhstan, or the KGB is now behind the political movement in Georgia. A lot of great coverage from inside Russia that never received any attention outside because it's like almost local news. But that is documented. We know what was going on. We just didn't pay any attention to it at the time, even when Putin instituted the first oil shutdown to Western Europe in 2006. It was just seen as part of a glitch. Nobody really took a close look at what was happening inside Russia. That didn't really occur. Everything we're talking about now, everything that we know now, really only started to surface about 2014 as the KGB's and Russian intelligence active measures started to move further west into Europe and into the U.S., and it was really only the major FBI bust of an extended Russian intelligence collection ring in New York City that kind of brought it to the American attention. Only in 2015 did we become, again, if you wanted to try to put dates to the Cold War, that might be the next significant date when the United States actually recognized something was happening.
Well, right. And then, you know, unless my memory doesn't serve me properly, right on time, exactly at that time, the, you know, what I keep referring to as the propaganda or the PR campaign, which was, you know, pro-Putin, trying to sell him to the English-speaking world as, look, this is a strong leader, one that is much stronger, and I mean, let's just get flat about it. He's a more manly type leader than the one that you have in the United States. This was sold to alt media at that time, rather effectively, and was sort of beginning to encroach into the, well, you know, they call it alt-right today, but frankly, there was a right-wing media strain out there that was in the, you know, corporate media that started to pick it up some. This all coalesces at exactly the time where we have the action that takes place over Crimea, right? So this is why it's so observable. But I'm wondering if this is also a time in which, you know, it's not like our intelligence or the Western intelligence assets were ever sitting still. This seemed to be the time, though, that it also started to become a bit more fashionable to talk about how the Russian Federation was indeed the logical successor when it comes to the threat, if you will, from the Soviet Union. You know, for a while there, that phrase that, well, we're generally the only world superpower, China's on the rise, but perhaps the Soviet Union, in one way or another, will rise up again in a new form. And this was starting to be discussed, but only in the right-wing and alternative media sort of centers at the time. I mean, that's what I observed. Maybe I'm wrong about it, but it's become a lot more prominent as the years have gone on, even though it seems as though we were encouraged not to really think anything of the circumstance in Crimea because at the time it was sort of sold as this is an ethnic situation where there are people that share cultures, language, with a mother organization, a mother nation, so to speak, that really organically want to rejoin with it. And therefore, it's sort of sold to us as this is just the logical and natural progression of this sort of a movement. So this is where things pivot, though. And now we have the introduction of, in my mind, a significantly more organized campaign to encourage people to believe that we are on the verge of another Cold War. And it could get warm now and then. It could get hot. Russian planes buzzing, American battleships. The reason why there's a bit of tension between military assets from China and America is really because of Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So where do we mark that change?
The same point in time, 2013, 2014. Up until then, I think most people are shocked when you tell them that actually Russia had joined NATO. Certainly the Russian commentators are not going to be mentioning that anymore. But in the 90s and into the early 2000s, Russia had actually joined NATO at certain levels in an effort for joint concerns about terrorism, sharing information against, the religious extremists. There were some joint ventures, some joint agendas, some things that they had in common. That really did not start to change. You didn't see Putin you didn't see the Russian president touting their nuclear weapons or their military or the sort of statements that you started to see 2013, 2014, 2015, where at that point in time you started to see major Russian aerial incursions, sending their long-range bombers around Alaska. Some of the practices of the Cold War that were quite standard back then, but we had not seen in between. And I think that's a dividing line when 2014, 2015, when Putin almost constantly begins to talk about Russia's atomic power and it being a superpower and his new massively destructive weapons, the new series of ICBMs, the new atomic cruise missiles, the new atomic global torpedo. Now, that was not part of the dialogue. Those sorts of threats and those sorts of posturing all came out in the middle of the last decade. And, you saw Russian bombers flying to South America. You saw Russian bombers making patrols through the Caribbean, which had not even happened during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
You also saw something that really did get NATO's attention, and I document this in Creative Chaos because it was so dramatically different at the time. I was kind of like, is this going to continue? Is this a short-term thing? But you saw a whole series of essentially Russian military, I wouldn't say strikes, but you would see whole assemblages of Russian bombers, fighters, and tankers flying directly towards Sweden, towards Norway, towards the other European countries, with simulated attacks, and most importantly, with their transponders turned off,
mm-hmm.
which really is worrisome because then they go off the radar, anything but military radar, and it's a pretty serious. We've not seen anything like that, and I'm not, as I recall, we didn't even see those kind of very directed threats during the Cold War. The U.S. did some with staging satellites directed towards Russia. Russia never did anything like that during the Cold War. So that's the date if you want to say, okay, it's on. It went from, suspecting things were changing to, okay, things have changed. When Putin announced his whole new complex of advanced atomic weapons, it pretty much tells you you're back.
Yeah, that was the time period in which they had, supersonic missile, right? And I think they actually put it on display briefly on Russian television.
And tested it.
Yeah.
And just this month, they announced that they've begun, and you have to kind of think about this, they've begun large-scale production of their long-range nuclear torpedoes,
mm-hmm.
which have atomic warheads so big that they are actually referred to as continent busters, that they could target them against the seaport, and actually the radiation effect would be massive across a whole geographic area, and they're producing them in quantity, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what they're saying. So, yeah, one was the nuclear cruise missile, which can fly around the world, attack from any angle. The other is their new Satan ICBM, multiple reentry warhead. So those were all a new generation of atomic weapons. And I think if you're talking about the Cold War, that kind of tells you we really scared the Soviet Union back in the 70s and 80s when we fielded a new generation of ICBMs with multiple reentry warheads on them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really, truly scared. They felt that was an escalation in the Cold War. So I think you would have to say what happened with those announcements from Putin told you that not only was the Cold War back, but they had just escalated it.
Well, and it goes far beyond the, what was explained as the reaction to our announcements regarding Star Wars, right? Where there was we need to amp up. They're going to have the space weapons ahead of us. This kind of thing. And I know that was part of the paradigm. Again, we're going back to like Reagan era here. So the Cold War was still matter of factly, a part of the equation. But there was a reaction from the Soviets. I mean, I've even heard some people, posit that, this indeed is the straw that was going to break the camel's back regarding the collapse of the Soviet Union, because they needed to react immediately and play catch up with us technologically. Now, this is all going on at the same time. We have the International Space Station. There's supposed to be a level of cooperation and all that. But this is a different time. This is when the Cold War is still happening. But there are some people that say that that's exactly what, caused the Soviet Union to collapse, is their need to keep up with us in the, here's the term you don't hear anymore, the arms race, if you will. Right? So all of these things are now shifted. We're not dealing with that. And the Cold War, even if it was an attempt to sort of reboot it, if you will, we don't have precisely the same circumstances now, especially due to the communication and media landscape that's publicly observable, because otherwise we were waiting on Cronkite or somebody, or rather, to tell us. Special report about what's going on in the Soviet Union. Very secretive, behind the Iron Curtain, right? These were the phrases, when I was a kid, that were, look, we have rarefied information about what's happening there. Nowadays, Putin can hold a press conference and people can watch it in real time. And that's a big difference from we have an announcement, here's a tape. And whatnot, and you had to wait for 60 Minutes to air that week, right? I mean, it's, good.
And now, any given day, I can log on to a site and see what's being shown on Moscow television from their own panel of commentators, which I'm glad more people don't, because it's scary stuff. These folks are insane. I mean, they're talking about going to nuclear war immediately, they're talking about entire West has become fascist, and we're going to invade. I mean, it's good news and bad news. You can see directly what they're thinking and talking about to their own population, and when you do, it's frightening.
Well, and see, this is where I observed something that we haven't even touched on yet, and I don't know how far you want to go into it, but the cultural significance of the conflict and what's being amped up in American media or English-speaking media, there are people right now talking about how this is a fabricated thing, that Putin is not really some kind of threat, that the Russian Federation is not some kind of threat. This is just being done so that we can relaunch the efforts to continue to fill the coffers of the military-industrial complex. I mean, it's very basic, right? But simultaneously, we do indeed have a new level of rhetoric and something that is different from the Soviet Union and its existence, in my mind, is this relationship between the Russian government and the Russian Orthodox Church. Now, I don't know how deeply you'd like to comment on that, but I think it is a significant thing when you have within a, you know, ethnically established culture, a largely influential organization like a church, you know, which is prominent among said culture, now kind of working in partnership, giving a blessing, if you will, to the government agency, not just a secular thing, but Putin is like a hero among some of the people that are speaking from the Russian Orthodox pulpit. So I don't know if you'd like to comment about that, but that is a big difference. Go ahead.
I think you captured it there. Before First Cold War, the rhetoric, the positioning inside the Soviet Union was communism. I mean, it was political views. It was a political passion. It was a Marx, Lenin. It was conceptual. It was idealistic, if you will, whatever. But it was passionate. But it was, you would get that rhetoric from the Communist Party and the Communist Party members and the people they had in power. So it came from the party. It did not necessarily represent Russian culture, the Russian people in general. Stalin had managed to mobilize Russian culture during World War II simply because they were being invaded. And at that point in time, it became, Father Stalin. It became very personal on the Russian family and Russian culture. That went away as soon as it was no longer necessary.
Well, and that's nothing special. Let's just be clear about that. That's nothing special, again. When a nation is under direct military threat, which the Soviet Union as a nation was, the Germans were literally invading part of their territory. So to create a codifying rally call for the citizenry, this is not unusual. This is just the way things work, right? So, but that's about self-preservation. And so was a lot of the rhetoric of the Cold War because what? The West was a big threat. They could, just like they were telling us here, they could at any moment decide that they wish to attack. So we need to be ready. You need to be ready. We need to have the weapons to be able to fire back, to be able to, deal with this one way or another. This works because you have a threat or, you know, a direct actual physical threat. Or you have the concept of a looming threat, the sword of Damocles, could drop upon us if we're not prepared, if we're not well-armed, if we're not at all times observant, right? But yeah. Go ahead.
That was something, but that was still, it was, if you looked at the basic existential, positioning, it was communism versus capitalism, East versus West. It was very conceptual. Right. It wasn't just the Russians. It was the Soviet Union and all the affiliated parties and all of the quote-unquote East, right? I mean, if you're old enough, you remember East versus West. And the Eastern Bloc wasn't just Russia. I mean, they wanted to bring in as much of Africa, as much as South America, as much as Asia. It was the Eastern Bloc against the Western Bloc.
Right.
Now we're seeing something totally different. And if you listen to the kind of dialogue that I'm talking about, it is very cultural. It's the religious heritage, which Putin started emphasizing heavily during the Olympics, when Russia hosted the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Eastern religion, Eastern Orthodoxy versus the West, which is essentially Russian. It's Russian culture, Russian language, Russian nationalism. There's no more political element to it. It is entirely ethnic and entirely nationalist. And quite frankly, want to be too entirely paranoid. Again, if you mm-hmm. listen to the people talking, it's not that we have something to offer. At least during the First World Cold War, it was the communists were saying, we have something to offer to the world, and people are opposing us because they just, you know, they're opposing us, and they're trying to stop our positive and future-oriented efforts moving towards communism and better societies. There's no discussion of that sort of thing now. It is strictly in terms of, we are Russia, everyone is against us, and we're at dire threat of being conquered. This mm-hmm. is a time when nobody's crossed the Russian border to do anything. But it is, I think, Chuck, the frightening thing is if you actually listen to the way they're talking, it's so much worse than Putin himself. On this cultural threat level of being under attack now, not possible attack, not opposition, but literally, oh, the one I recently saw today, video out of a Russian school, essentially shows mm-hmm. it's a reenactment of Russian tanks going against German tanks. And now the German tanks aren't German tanks, they're Western tanks. So they're kind of falling back into this survivalist mode, if you will, that you just described.
Right.
When they're not at risk. There is no military action. Nobody's crossed the border into Belarus. Nobody, you know, it's not there. But they're making the population feel that they are at direct risk. That they're, you know, so it's not at all like the first Cold War.
Right, and that leads to another question. I promise I'm going to lay off after this because we don't have you for the full 2 hours tonight. But it's an important question, I think. Does this appear to be, because as you stated, as I stated, you don't have a direct physical threat which is being presented, right? So is this mobilization, if you will, more about an honest belief among the population that they are indeed under, you know, that sort of sword of Damocles thing I described before where, you know, it's imminent. There is a possibility of this coming, like, right now, any moment. Is it more like that, or is this a... I hate to do this, because I know I'm going to get angry mail just for this question. Is this just an attempt to deflect from what I think is observable aggression from Putin, his regime, the Russian state, you know, and that's it. You know, we're not being aggressive. Don't talk to us about our aggressions. We're under threat. Is it just deflection, or is there an organic element to this where the population, whether it's been encouraged to or it has just observed through other circumstances, that this is what is to be discussed? This is part of the group psychology, if you will. Or is it just the deflection of, like, you know, don't blame us for being aggressive. We're at all times under threat. Which one of these two things sounds better to you, or am I just crazy for even thinking this way?
Officially, it's deflection. Because Putin, in a statement this past week, said literally, we are only doing this special operation because Ukraine has been at war with Russians in the Donbass since 2014. Ukraine started it. Now, he doesn't say, of course, that the Russians in the enclaves in the Donbass succeeded from Ukraine and declared themselves autonomous. And, you know, he doesn't say that. What he really, the official posturing is a deflection that says the special operation is to come to the aid of our countrymen who Kiev, not Ukraine, Kiev has been attacking since 2014. This is not new, folks. You really understand this fight started in 2014, which it did, and we have just decided to go all in and come to their aid because otherwise they're going to be massacred. That's the official party line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do some number of Russians actually believe that? that aren't just, you know, hearing it on their news. Yeah, some do. That there are some, and you have to assume they're sincere when they say that, you know, Russian nationalism essentially trumps everything else. Mm-hmm. Wherever there are Russian speakers, they are part of the Russian nation, and we need to support them. They deserve to be autonomous. You know, they need to, we need to give them the right to be autonomous. It is pure Russian speaker nationalism. And there's a belief in that. Russians are Russians and deserve to be autonomous and associated with the Russian nation in whatever form. So, you know, it's a combination. Interestingly, there were probably more of the latter a year ago. I mean, there's no doubt one of the fascinating things is one of the most supportive regions in Ukraine outside the autonomous enclaves of Luhansk and Donetsk, it would be Odessa, mm-hmm. which was largely Russian-speaking. And, of course, now that Russia has been attacking Odessa for the better part of the year, that's disappeared. Because they were doing it to the, you know, they didn't play the ball, you know, even-handedly. But bottom line answer to your question is, yeah, there is a percentage of support for pure Russian nationalism. And most of the speakers that are on their media that I hear when, you know, they're conscribed, they have these panel discussions and large media groups that are talking about it, are those pure Russian nationalists. Who are not, they don't have to, they're not even parting, the Putin's line is not their driving force, it's like, it's the pure nationalism rather than, oh, we're defending, you know, a special military operation. They think of it as war. And they use the word war even when Putin does not.
Right, which is why I find it very interesting how the American media has tried to sort of shape this narrative now that, look, there's a bunch of resistance, right? They showed us the Russian mothers were starting to complain despite the fact that they would be punished for protesting because, indeed, it'll be them who see their young sons come back dead from this circumstance, right, from this special operation or war. We saw that. We saw the, well, there's people that are going to protest even though they're going to go to prison. You know, and I see the American media doing that. And it's very strange because if you do tune to the Russian panels and stuff and you try and follow what's going on, which I have, not the English-speaking stuff, mind you, but the stuff where I'm getting translations, it does not sound like there is a great deal of public resistance, say, to what's happening. I mean, the nationalist justification is seemingly the topic of every one of those panels anymore. Right? I mean, it's not about protecting anybody.
And yeah. I think what we're looking at the culmination, and, you know, I write about it in Creating Chaos, that Putin spent the better part of a decade reinstituting a internal security system right. that's at least as effective as the Soviet Union was, but much more technological. They have all of they have artificial intelligence that monitors each and every telephone conversation on the public network and the cell networks. They have an extensive, I mean, literally, Putin's Russia and China right at the moment, they have such an internal security apparatus that, you know, you can't protest and get away with it now. In the early days of the war, the only way that you could effectively protest, because some of the Russians, I think, remember there was a point in time when, I think, 24 city councilmen from major Russian cities opposed the war
right.
and disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Oligarchs that opposed the war fell out of windows or mm-hmm. boats or whatever, you know, and the Russians being smart people and, you know, that became really quickly understood that, no, you don't protest. So your choices are to leave or just duck your head and do what you can. And, of course, now this week, effectively, they are starting to close the borders
right.
For foreign travel. So, no, I think it's changed. There, and I don't think that the Western media has caught up with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. Maybe they don't want to appear Russophobic or whatever, but I don't really see much media coverage of what's really happening inside Russia and of the dialogues that you and I are talking about that are on Russian media.
Right.
I see nobody in the mainstream media has replayed one of those Russian TV programs that we're talking about.
Oh, but no, and they're not showing any sort of open debate about anything. See, that's the interesting part here. And this is where now we're going to get into something dicey, because I certainly am not asking you to prognosticate. But given that the last time that the American media even attempted to show us something, it seems like of significance from inside Russia, it seemed to be the resistance, if you will, or limited resistance to that mobilization, right? Where they were going to call up more troops. Obviously, they needed more people to get this done. This is now dragged on a bit. That's the American media representation. But what does all of this history now kind of suggest we're going to see next, Larry? Again, I hate to ask you to predict. I'm just saying, is there a fairly discernible trajectory that we see all of this going in regarding, you know, how the threat is to be perceived by the West, what the interaction's going to be? I mean, we obviously know that the point of contention being Ukraine and these weapons now coming in, and all of that is happening. But what does it tell us about what we're going to see in the future, given what it is this has all been running up to? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I do, in terms of the media coverage. And you and I have talked about this a little bit before.
Mm.
The major mainstream media has very little of any foreign coverage. It's not just on Russia. It's anywhere. They don't have the overseas correspondent network they once have. They have virtually no field reporting. They, for whatever reason, don't pull off some of the feeds that we're talking about, or whatever. But they have lost the ability to do a lot of foreign reporting, unless it's a headline story. Okay, did Russia launch 57 ballistic missiles against Ukraine? Yeah, we cover that, but you know where they got it? They got it from Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
Or they got it from... They're repeating somebody else's news. So what I think you're going to see is, especially with the situation in Washington now, it's going to become more political coverage of what the West did in Ukraine, was money wasted? Did we send the right weapons? I think it's going to be more Western media coverage of what the West did, good, bad, you know, corruption, bad planning, whatever. We're going to be covering ourselves, not the Russians.
Mm.
That would be my guess, because A, we don't have the ability, and we have become, there's a good word for it, incestuous in political coverage.
Right, right.
It's just so much easier to cover our own politics that's where all the time is spent.
Yeah, right now I think we're gonna still endure quite a few months, I think, of this whole, you know, where follow the classified documents game, you know, with Pence having some, and what did Biden have? Why does he still have it? What's eventually, maybe somebody will get, you know, the idea that classified documentation is actually mishandled constantly, and what the problem is.
Nobody gets trained on it either.
No,
it's like I wonder why. Nobody has time when they come into office to train people on what they're supposed to do. But here's an example. I'll get this out on the table.
Sure.
The lead story today, maybe not the lead story, but one of the lead stories for this week is that a Central African Republic has essentially ordered all its French forces out. The French forces were acting in the field, acting against the Muslim fundamentalist rebels that mm-hmm. really threatened this government. But the reason that African government is kicking them all out is because the deal that they cut with the Wagner Group, and they are turning security for the entire country over the Wagner Group.
Mm-hmm.
The Wagner Group has become a multinational force. It has fantastic amounts of financial reserves from Africa. And there was a little story that we designated them as a terror organization, but there should have been a whole series of stories about why and why they're such a threat internationally.
In case somebody is not aware, could you give us a brief summation when you mentioned the Wagner Group, what the Wagner Group actually is?
The Wagner Group is a private military company, and of course under Russian law, private military companies don't exist, but they do, because the head of the Wagner Group was one of Putin's primary supporters and probably got more money over the dismemberment of the Soviet Union than anybody else, did extremely well, better than most of the other oligarchs, started as a very ultra-nationalist, a very brutal guy, started this private military company, and it's appeared around the world. Its fighters were key in the takeover of Crimea. Its fighters are busy in North Africa and Central Africa. And basically what they do is, his approach is, it's all about brute military force, but use it only where you can make a lot of money off of it.
Hmm.
For example, in Africa, the way they would do is they would go in and cut a internal security deal to protect a government that wasn't very popular, let's say, and deploy a lot of weaponry and a lot of people to protect. You know, this is kind of like a Russian Blackwater. Sorry, people aren't going to like that, but it's a very smart move because they're very selective in where they, you know, get their financing. But as part of their security deal, they would enforce a whole series of contracts over minerals and mineral reserves and oil, very, very lucrative contracts. So they're providing security and being paid for that, but at the same time, they've essentially demanded access, first rights on almost all the mineral rights for the country. And so it's very capitalistic, makes a lot of money, and provides it has had a lot of success in nations where there isn't really a popular government, where the leadership feels threatened. Syria was another place where Wagner deployed a lot of people to fight in support of the Syrian regime. So that's and much of what they're doing, we don't even know. I suspect our intelligence services do, but they have a target list of countries where they can do what I described and make the most money possible. And they've made so much money that now they are independently contracting weapons.
Mm-hmm.
They've actually set up their own R&D inside Russia, and they are in competition with the Russian military for weapons, and it's generally felt that they in Ukraine, they have far superior weapons than the Russian army and the mobilized folks because they can buy them and afford them. And they just contract them wherever they can get them. Except they do complain that they don't get first choice of Russian equipment.
Well, right. And the very positive, flexible nature of this is that you simultaneously have plausible deniability if you are utilizing them, if you're Putin and you're utilizing them, basically, or you're, you know, part of the power structure in the Russian Federation, you can utilize them and either claim, you know, some level of plausible deniability or take responsibility as you wish. This is what happened with Blackwater, right? Where you had this military contracting group that when things went the way you wanted them to, you could sort of attach yourself to it and say, well, we dispatched them. And then in other cases, you could claim that they are an independent organization. We have no control over them.
It's very very flexible, and I think it's interesting. One of the things going on inside Russia is kind of taking a force like this, and especially since it's known, even they admit that the majority of recruits that they have now fighting in Ukraine are out of Russian prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, again, it's a very cheap source of manpower, and we know enough now to say that the good news is if you go with the Wagner Group, you probably have better equipment. The bad news is their rules of engagement are absolutely merciless. There is no retreat. It's a fascinating study, but it looks very much like the Russian conscripts during World War II.
Well, see, there's the interesting thing. I saw reports on it recently that, effectively were making the point that this is a great way to take the unwanted prisoners you have and repurpose them, because if they're killed in action, well, then at least we don't have the worry of them returning to society. And at the same time, it puts them to good use. You know, they get to make a contribution, if you will. But there were people talking about this, the way that they engage with the enemy and things like that. They're not subject to any sort of rules of conduct that, you might imagine for, say, American forces are supposed to be subject to, right? Anything like that. And even the Russians' rules for conduct and what it is they're allowed to do in a theater of engagement, they don't have to adhere to any of that.
Actually, the Wagner Group leader has even asked for special legislation this past week in Russia. Because apparently he wants special legislation that will confirm their rights, because if and when some of them do come back to Russia, they need to be treated as heroes rather than the fact that they were formerly serial rapists or pedophiles or, so he wants special legislation to erase all of that stuff and make sure that they're treated, with the respect they're due, regardless of what they've done.
Regardless of what their past was before joining the Wagner Group, or their behavior while with the Wagner Group, the way I understood it, it doesn't matter. An amnesty, if you will, if they survive and serve their purpose. I mean, is that about what the...
That's about it. I guess because it's hard to tell if this is true or not, but apparently in a couple of locations where some of them have come back, police authorities are actually concerned and have issued some local warnings because these guys are so out of it. I mean, they are clearly had lengthy, violent criminal histories.
Right.
And so I guess they've been maybe even issued some warnings, and that really triggered him to make this response. And I'm like, well, yeah, but don't be afraid of them. Treat them with respect, and maybe they won't kill you.
Right. Lovely situation. So, and that's only one element of what's going on here. So I wanted to point that out. I'm glad you brought it up, because I was trying to figure out how to get to this discussion, actually, in that legislation that I saw. Might have been a week and a half ago, whatever. It's very recent. And it's a real thing. Some people are dismissing that as another attempt to demonize Russia, because again, this is one of the thrusts from some of the English-speaking media outlets, is that this is nothing but a construct. This is all a fabrication to make sure that there is nothing more than just a boogeyman here, so that this will be useful for, guess what, a new Cold War. Because, let's be honest, Larry, terrorism and extremist terrorism is not selling that well. I mean, they're telling us about Iran and how they're executing their own people who are protesting. And I feel like collectively the American viewers, if you will, are sort of shrugging their shoulders. The war on terror is not going to be marketable anymore, it seems. So logically, what do you do if you're in that business? You got to replace them with a new villain. And I think there's some truth to that, but...
Unfortunately, yeah. In this case, one of them stepped forward. I mean, I would prefer it if we just had to go look for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this is not a black and white situation to my mind. Now, maybe you see it differently, and I'll let you wrap up on this or whatever it is that you want to, because I know you wanted to get going around now, and I've taken you a little over. But the fact is that it seems to me as though it's not an either or situation here. This is not a vaporous a boogeyman who is being invented whole cloth out of nothing, number one. But it is also maybe not quite the exact threat that some people are trying to pose. I mean, I feel as though the looming threat of nuclear war may have been overplayed a bit by the Western media for a little while. But again, I felt as though the general viewers' adherence, if you will, to that information stream kind of shrugged their shoulders a bit about, okay, nuclear war is not so believable. Even though I think that they were trying to sell that for a bit, is that we could be on the brink directly of a nuclear conflict with the Russian Federation. I think people didn't bite, if you will, Larry, but the threat is not fictitious, but it's also maybe not, you know, at the level that they were claiming at the time. So I'm of like two minds on this at all times. Maybe that's actually the point of all of it, is that that's where I'm supposed to be, is confused. I don't know. So Larry, I'll tell you, I do. I'm putting this out there that it's sort of like I'm trying to analyze these things and get a grip on it, see what's, you know, really happening, and not just by the propaganda, and not just by the strategies, if you will, from our military, from our government, from the Western governments in general. I'm not trying to buy into the Putin end of the spectrum either, but it's very difficult to actually figure out what's really happening and how intense each of these threats really is. And meanwhile, I am certainly not being confronted by the same thing that someone living in Ukraine is. Where, you know, again, a place the size of Texas is now a war zone, seemingly across the whole nation. Maybe I'm buying into some propaganda there, but go ahead.
I think that's what makes it different, Chuck, because they're kind of two levels of threats, two levels of concern, two levels of things that show up in the media. Yeah, I think the problem is that Putin himself was the one. The Russians were themselves the ones that continuously introduced the nuclear threat at first, mm-hmm. talking about all their next generation nuclear weapons, talking about the fact that there's a superpower, you know, and I think the response to that was they kind of started the dialogue, and we kind of went along with it, because I think, right. as you and I have discussed before, a lot of people really don't understand the realities of nuclear warfare and the difference between a tactical nuke and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, at that level, I think it does tend to get overplayed. I think to some extent, I often wonder if it's Putin's way of trying to do to us what Star Wars did to them. You brought that up earlier. It's kind of like, if I can make them spend lots more money and be really concerned, I'm not going to start a nuclear war, so, you know, make them spend money. Make them go to an entire new generation of ICBMs. That's good. And we'll spend it on tanks. So I think at that level, there is... It's mixed. I think the one thing about this that's different than a lot of, if you will, propaganda or whatever, you can parse out the quote-unquote Russian threat or the NATO threat or whatever threat you want that's existential and talk about it and that it, you know, is Russia going to invade Finland? I don't think so. Is Russia going to harass the Norwegian countries? Yeah, that's just part of this active measures thing that we've talked about. But where it falls apart is there's absolutely no doubt of what's happening on the ground.
Right.
So if you have two different discussions, one is at kind of a strategic level, you can try to wade through the chaos and the concerns and what's overblown and what's not, because much of it is overblown, as you say. But when you get into what's happening on the ground, there's just no question about that. I mean, there is no question that Russia, for a year, said that they had no intentions to invade Crimea, and they did.
Mm.
And they had no intentions to mass their forces, it's all an exercise, and invade Ukraine, and they did. I mean, there's, when you get down to that level of practical, real world, what's happening on the ground, I don't see it as black and white at all.
No.
There's just what happened happened, and it was the rest. I would agree with the president's statement. Russia is not a single Russian soldier, national, whatever, is under any threat if they just go back across the border.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you, but this does not bode well for this idea, though. I mean, it is still a potential problem that we could be indeed sold a hyperbolic version of a conflict here, and I think that's something to be on the lookout for. But also, you should absolutely be on the lookout for anything written by Larry Hancock, and you can go to larry-hancock.com and follow through, check out his blog, check out his books, everything else. In closing, Larry, anything that you'd like to say here?
No, I think we covered it well. I think what we've done is it is Cold War II, and I think you did a good word is there. Cold War I had hyperbole all over it.
Mm-hmm.
There was a missile gap, there was a bomber gap, there was this, there was that. It was like there was always a strategic thing that somebody was playing, right?
Right.
So we could get trapped into that again. We should try to avoid that in Cold War II. We should avoid that hyperbole. Just kind of restrain yourself.
Right. Well, that would be a good idea, but is that the way that this game is usually played? Not so often, I would say, Larry, but we'll continue to discuss this. I mean, there you go. Cold War 2.0 with author Larry Hancock, and obviously I'll recommend here his book, Creating Chaos, because that does focus on a good deal of the material that we covered, although a lot of things have happened since that book was published. And I think if people would have read it before these things happened, they might have had a better lens on what they're looking at today. Larry Hancock, thanks so much for joining me tonight, sir.
Great to be back.
Anyway, we'll have Larry back sometime in the next couple of weeks. Maybe after I go off air here, I'll find out when. And the Ocelli Effect will return after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Revelation through conversation.
I want them to appreciate the incredible job we're doing. We are doing a job the likes of which has never been done before. You're going to have mental depression for people. You're going to have large numbers of suicides.
Ocelli.com.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue. Thank you.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia,
by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War,
by author Mike Swanson.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks, by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Mad Prophet on the airways. I am here every Thursday, 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock Pacific time, right here on the Ocelli Radio Network, which is really one of the most, I think it's the gem in the landscape of media today. Please donate, buy a coffee and some smokes for my man, my producer, and the owner of this network, Chuck, today by donating at Ocelli.com. Keep it alive. Keep it alive.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Ocelli.com.
final segment of the Thursday Ocelli Effect tonight. And again, special thanks to Larry Hancock for coming on a little early, because we did not have Mike Swanson with us this week, but he will return next week. And Larry will be back on the 9th of February. And as February kicks in, we're going to start doing things a little differently on the network. A couple things are going to happen. I'll be releasing the show with the Greek that we did on Monday very shortly. And when that's done, you guys are going to learn about the new situation there, where there's going to be a subscriber-based just Ocelli and the Greek. And that's going to start happening in February. And it's separate from the regular subscriptions here. The Greek thinks we can charge $25 for somebody to have that for the month. So that's the way it's going to go. And I'm not the only one who's going to receive payment on that. So just saying, gotta divide it up. So yeah, that is that's what that's going to be. $25 a month for the new Ocelli and the Greek series, which is going to go well beyond the old Ocelli and the Greek series. Anyway, that's not the banner headline. I've also got some stuff I got to do with Chris Graves shortly, and we're going to have some more additions to the audiobook section, not just the continuation of my story, but a few other pieces going into the audiobook section. So that's going to get recorded, I think, tomorrow, and should be out over the weekend, and all of that. Meanwhile, we're going to start offering every show on the network is going to have a little announcement with it now that says, look, you want to actually sponsor the show. We're going to offer options for that out to people directly. I mean, it was always there, but we're going to put little announcements in there to remind listeners that they can indeed support what it is they're listening to. So if you got a project, a book, a blog, you got a business, you know, as long as you're not selling something that is completely horrific and poisonous to people, we'll be more than happy to share the love, promote through the network. And again, every host will benefit by that, as well as the network being strengthened by it. So, all right, enough of all the business stuff, because at all times, I'm getting tired of saying, you know, you can donate, da-da-da. I'm getting tired of doing that. I feel like an idiot asking for donations. I really do. I've never been comfortable with it. So how about we just sell you something, either your own spot as part of the podcast and broadcast network, and also you get played on the radio station during the random replays in addition to your insertions, right? And if we just get a handful of sponsors who really just, you know, take care of business, well, we don't need to run a lot of little spots and things. But who knows, you might learn about some new stuff. I mean, I know I've got listeners who are doing some really cool things. And, you know, we advertise who we do on here, and I don't like to focus on ads. I'd rather focus on the material. So anyway, all of that aside, although I will tell you that, again, at all times, supporting the network is necessary, and I appreciate you when you do. And those of you that do, I'm trying to come up with new and creative ways to repay the favor. One way or another, give you something for the favor that you give us for being able to do this independently without corporate sponsorship, without somebody telling us what we can and cannot say. One thing is that, you know, even when you listen to Jack Blood, who was on earlier, you get to hear him constantly say, you know, I love going out and talking to people and doing this, and but this is the only place I'm allowed to actually speak my mind, and somebody's not trying to get down my throat about I said the wrong thing. I used the wrong parlance, if you will, for certain terminology. Can't say Chinese New Year anymore. I said it. You're not allowed to, even though it's a scientific term, you're not allowed to talk about something being retarded. Not even a flame retardant is allowed to be discussed on corporate platforms, right? You certainly can't object to anything that might jab you in the skin. You're not supposed to talk badly about bad medicine. And I don't mean the horrible Bon Jovi song. I do mean the bad medicine that's out there, the ugly juju that comes in chemical form. No, you're not allowed to talk about that. And you could just be a racist if you do. I don't know how that works exactly, but then again, I didn't know how encouraging self-harm comes up when I was talking about President Kennedy and his Vietnam policy. I mean, I guess in a way, you encourage self-harm if you encourage people to join the military. Did I just say that out loud? I think I did. And I really, really don't like to do it, but you get criticized, you get bashed, you get deplatformed, defunded, if you will. Which they did the exact opposite of here in Atlanta recently, and we have Cop City, which is now because of yet another shooting. I mean, how many, you know, look, I don't like to blame the guns. It's one of the things that makes me uncomfortable when I talk to Maria Heller on Hell and High Water, is that she kind of blames the guns. I don't. I blame the damaged psychology and spirituality of people that causes them to believe that life should be thrown away because of a conflict. And, you know, shooting each other is just one way to create a short-term solution to a long-term problem. Or maybe it's a short-term solution to a problem that will go away all on its own. Or who the hell knows? No value for life. That's the problem, not the gun. But, okay. And by the way, that paradigm does get all over everybody, whether they're wearing a uniform or they're just on their way to somewhere where people wear uniforms because maybe the only thing they can afford to do is go to McDonald's or Wendy's or, God help you, a bar or something, where indeed people have to wear uniforms. So it's all about uniformativity. Wait a minute. Uniformity. That's what it is. Uniformity. It's all about the uniforms. If you visit people with uniforms, you might get yourself killed on the way because a Big Mac is worth dying for, right? Or maybe you just got into a traffic stop like this kid did in Memphis, right? Tyree Nichols. Oh, I know. I'm not supposed to talk about that because on the one hand, I'm white, so shut up. And on the other hand, right? On the other hand, it's probably all faked anyway, right? Everybody's a crisis actor. It's so frustrating that we cannot even, at this point in time, stipulate with one another that a reality has occurred, that a situation has happened, that somebody has died, maybe because you got a busted taillight or an expired tag or something. It's not worthy of the death penalty. Oh, no, 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 no. You don't understand. The cities are out of control. Well, I'll tell you, Cop City in Atlanta, where they instituted a good deal of police state tactics, gave new weapons, amped everything up. We now have a mess over there. We definitely have action in the street. Oh, I know. It's all about Antifa, right? It's all the leftists. That's what the problem is. And Antifa doesn't actually exist as you think it does. If you think there's some sort of organization, anarchists wearing uniforms. Hey, there goes those uniforms again. Uniformity. Because they're all supposed to be in the same kind of uniforms, and they wind up buying their boots in the same place, even though... No, no, no. There is an Antifa, by the way, but it's more like a communication hub. It's a leaderless organization. But I'm not allowed to tell you the truth about that either. This is why no alt-media person wants to have me on their shows anymore. Although I might do one of these digging with Chris Graves things in the next day or so, and see if I can piss off his listeners. Because he's got a whole separate group of listeners there in the Chris Graves media universe. And I am going to be a guest on Digging with Chris Graves, or Digging Chris Graves. I don't know. Is it Digging Graves? Definitely it's Digging Graves. Maybe I got the title of the show wrong. Anyway, I'll tell you about that as time goes on. And we'll talk about a whole lot more of this kind of stuff on Friday. But, oh yeah, back to the headlines and the strife in the street, if you will. It's still supposed to be about the left and right wing paradigm, right? And the encouragement of being woke and awake, and there's a big difference there. Yeah, no kidding. Which, by the way, someone who is partially awake is dangerous, just so you know. And those that appear to be awake or woke, that are in motion, you know, I used to hear all kinds of things about how you got to treat sleepwalkers. And I gotta say, nobody heeded all those warnings. Sleepwalkers all around us being woke and awake, allegedly, and also being part of some sort of movement, etc. Yeah, movement, woke, wake, sorta, kinda. Sleepwalkers are dangerous. don't get part of the story, get the whole thing. And by the way, try and observe it for yourself. Since again, nobody can stipulate to your reality, your truth, ever, right? These are things I consider, especially late at night when I'm having troubles, which I had a couple of days ago. This is why we didn't fill out as many shows this week as I planned on. Next week, going into February, you know, the shortest alleged month of the alleged year, Black History Month and all that good stuff, 28 days to it, right? Or is it 29 this year? I forget. Well, one of these years it'll be 29, leap year and all. Although that calendar still doesn't work out right. Yeah, that's happening. And in February, we'll be doing a lot more shows. And I'm also going to re-release some old stuff because people forgot what it is I've done in the past. So thinking I've already got these recordings ready while I'm working on these other projects, we'll put out some old stuff. But back to the news of the day. A document here, a document there, a document everywhere. Old MacDonald had some classified documents. And Joe said, E-I-E-I-O, no malarkey, right? And, oh, Mike Pence somehow has documentation that he shouldn't. And, of course, Trump and the raid, and he was treated unfairly. And now we're going to see how unfairly they can treat the other side of the alleged paradigm. But as I mentioned with Larry in the first part of the show today, and maybe somebody ought to take a look at the fact that nobody's actually aware of how to handle these things properly to begin with. And, oh, by the way, you know, that Hillary email thing? Really, when you boil it down and you knock off all the partisan nonsense, here's what should have happened there. She should have been held accountable for mishandling of classified documentation. Because that's what she actually did. Wrong. Okay? I mean, you know, in that instance, I'm not saying that represents the entirety of all of her crimes and, you know, and the elements of what was committed by the Clinton franchise of the Bush crime family. No, not at all. I'm not saying that represents even a significant portion. But in that instance, that people wanted to scream about servers and emails and unauthorized communications, the truth is that it goes back to exactly that. Now, does this also mean that somebody is constantly mishandling classified documentation? I mean, you know, these are the people we're supposed to trust, and don't you feel safe? Because if they're protecting our secrets, you know, this is supposed to be our stuff, right? They're protecting our interests, really. And thusly, by extension, they have to protect some of the secrets, because if you let your enemies know everything, or if you let it out there to the wide world, first problem is you're an idiot. And if you're going to conduct these different, you know, campaigns, active measures, and conflicts over spheres of influence, as governments and organizations like this do, it would be malpractice to just have absolute transparency, so don't be an idiot. But I'll tell you, I think if you dug deep enough, you'd find that anybody who bothered to read classified documentation probably mishandled it. And you know why? They don't know what they're doing. At all. They don't know what the standards are. They don't know what the proper behaviors are. That requires, ready, training. That requires a bit of a knowledge base. And you know how it works, right? I mean, the king does not have to know anything about his subjects in order to rule over them. And these middle managers don't need to know how business works to command entire groups of employees or serfdom, which are below them. Why would they need to have any actual knowledge? I mean, what are you, silly? You think that people that are making decisions that affect your life are supposed to know anything about the decisions they're making other than this is what they're supposed to do and they got to take their marching orders? Oh, we're back to those sleepwalkers again, aren't we? And the majority of the people that you encounter here and there and everywhere, much like classified documentation. I made a comment, actually. A relative of mine was frustrated about getting information about a family member on Facebook. I just saw this yesterday. And I said, you know, it's pretty fascinating. I really think that the Omerta, J. Edgar Hoover, the NSA, and all those people have nothing on how well family secrets are held in my bloodline, if you will. And I thought it was funny. This guy's frustrated. He can't find out information about his father that he's been looking for years and years. He's older than me. And he's like kind of giving up. And I said, well, you know, interesting, though. We can learn more about the malfeasance of our government than we can about our own family when it comes to certain things, huh, Uncle Steve? Anyway, pay no attention to that. I just thought that that was interesting, that there's always secrets to behold, and most people do indeed mishandle them, and that's how they're no longer secrets. But here we go. That's going to be a big news headline as we transition into the time when Hunter Biden becomes one of the most important people in the country, because he might indeed be the element or the mechanism, excuse me, by which the big guy is taken down. Joe Biden, who, just look at him, isn't he a threat to you and me and everyone? Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. And pay no attention to Trumpy and all his friends. I mean, they'll select somebody for you to select in 2024, whether it's him or not. Don't worry. They will definitely have a middle manager for you to select. I mean, you can't leave options on any restaurant's menu blank. And that's what it is. They'll tell you what's available on the menu. And you can pick from what they've already picked for you. I mean, that's the way that works, right? Because you got to pick from the left or the right. And I mean, Biden, I mean, would he even survive another term? I don't know. Hey, I'm back to the sleepwalkers again, aren't I? Except that one snips your hair instead of wanting to eat your brains, because it's not the zombie apocalypse just yet. Or maybe it is. I actually feel as though the alt media has entered a time of zombie apocalypse, but, you know, nobody wants my opinion. Anyway, about these tanks and all that stuff in Ukraine, isn't it amazing that that's still going on? I'm not going to go into it in depth here because we've had enough of that from the discussion with Larry, and I advise you to go back to the part one of it, but man, oh man, here we are. And what about Tyre Nichols? And there's apparently a tape out there in the Memphis police, indeed, as was pointed out on an earlier show today and has been pointed out on, oh, I don't know, every news feed that is. The circumstances here where, you know, five cops, I think it is, are going to be fired and all that good stuff and charged with murder. And there were explanations on various media outlets earlier today explaining the difference between a murder and a manslaughter charge and how it is you can intentionally kill somebody versus, well, accidentally. Or I didn't think that that would be a reasonable conclusion to my actions if I took said actions. But I'm not here to explain legalese to you, am I? Already covered the failure of Cop City. You know, mass shootings are up. You guys don't want to hear me talk about that, do you? I mean, somebody's going to tell me it's all fake anyway, and it's a crisis action, and it's all about taking away your Second Amendment. You're right. It's all about that. Doubt it. I think it's about instituting a further deeply driven nail into the casket of, you know, what once might have been your ability to feel as though fear was not the absolute mood of the day every single day. I mean, you got to be afraid to go out in public now because there have been, in less than 30 days, I don't know, we had 39 or 40 mass shootings now? How many is there? I mean, there's that thing that happened out in Monterey, that's for sure. You got a couple of Walmarts, you got some workplace shootings, you got mass shootings all over the place, and all that stuff they talked about with the dance hall and everything. Turns out maybe a lot of that was false. And oh, by the by, what's going on with that murder suspect, or which murder suspect, right? Because we have, the guy who seems to have clearly slaughtered his wife after making comical searches to his internet, you know, how long before a body smells, when can you actually, how long does DNA last? I forget the rest of it. I mean, it's like, do you move a body this way? Are you allowed to inherit money from your dead wife? Et cetera, et cetera. And then his wife disappears. I mean, not a good look. Who the hell doesn't know that somebody can access your internet searches, especially if you use Google, but don't be fooled by the whole, well, I'm not using Google, because most of these systems are actually infiltrated, connected to Google anyway, so it is what it is. But, I mean, who doesn't know that searching on your smartphone, your device, your stupid tablet, whatever, who doesn't know that your Fondle Slab of choice at all times is accessible? I mean, if for nothing else other than a corporate capitalist surveillance. I mean, so that they can figure out exactly which commercials to feed you. Right? I mean, I'm not even allowed to watch Beavis and Butthead without a streamer asking me what to reveal my location. Because somehow that's going to be relevant, even on a commercial-free platform. See, if there were commercials, I'd say, given that they want to target me precisely, you know, no point in telling me about a particular type of store that's eight states away from me. If I want to go visit a store, and no point in maybe telling me about, I don't know, feminine hygiene products if you know I'm a male. Or, am I a male? Am I a man? I know I'm a man, but the computer might not. I mean, the AI will figure it out eventually, but at the same time, I get it when you're trying to capitalize on the information and you're trying to monetize properly and you want to make sure that you target your audience correctly, even if it's an audience of one. I get all that, but same time, I was just watching Beavis and Butthead commercial-free on a stream. I don't think they need to know where I am because they're not even going to try and sell me fast food that may or may not be in my area. Anyhow, I guess that's a pointless pattern of thoughts I didn't even need to bother sharing with you, but hey, I'll keep doing it anyway. What else is going on the planet, in the world? Well, there's plenty of people that are going to keep kicking up something about there's bad drugs out there. And there's good drugs out there, maybe. We have the possible legalization of the medical finally in the state of Georgia going on. But throughout the state, frankly, law enforcement has found itself in a bit of a catch situation, a snafu, if you will, because they need to be able to prove, unless you're completely ignorant of this, if they catch you with some cannabis here in Georgia in your possession, they need to be able to prove that you actually have cannabis in your possession. Now, how do you do that? You have to examine the substance and prove that it's indeed cannabis. Well, the equipment that most of the law enforcement has in the state of Georgia could effectively tell them that a hemp-based product, which is legal, a CBD product, which is legal, in the state up to a certain tolerance of THC, very small, minute fraction, is legal. Their equipment currently throughout the majority of the state doesn't allow them to see the difference between the legal CBD and the fully loaded cannabis product with the THC in it. So if you have half a brain or you have a lawyer who knows this, you can't be prosecuted because they literally do not have the proof to prosecute you with. They must prove that the substance is of said controlled nature. And if your claim reasonably is that it's of a legal nature, it's just you can't tell the difference, you should be able to walk on it. Most people are not, so I guess it's a good thing. The incremental legalization of the medical, of course, decriminalization would be the best thing. And in fact, how about leave us the hell alone-ization would be the ultimate, but and I'm not even a guy, I haven't smoked cannabis. Well, I haven't smoked cannabis in a long time. I haven't even eaten any cannabis in some time now. I'm doing much better with just the occasional use of the psychedelic, which, oh, is getting legalized in some places. But again, we're going to go through this circumstance where the actual spirit, the nature of the plant, the nature of the organically grown thing is not going to be respected or utilized properly. But I guess I got to be happy that at least a few less people might end up spending lengthy sentences in a box for possession of a plant or a fungus. You know, not even a weapon. Not something horrible and exploitative or anything, but a plant or a fungus. This indeed can land you in a cell for a while in a lot of places. Anyway. All right, well, I am almost done for the night. I'm thinking of a couple other things that I just might run through before I'm done. But in the meantime, I guess I'm going to take a very, very short break here and straighten out something that I have physically in front of me that needs to be dealt with. But why don't you stick around and take a listen to maybe a song or two or something like that? And I will close out this particular Thursday Ocelli Effect after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
Final segment for tonight. Here we go. And I don't have a lot left to say. I just want to get a couple of things out there before we're done today. Tomorrow night I'll be going and doing the live open mic night. Now, the rules have changed on that. We're going to actually have a directed subject, which this week B. Pete and I will each bring a news article of some type or an issue, and we're going to split the first hour between us. No guest this week. However, I think we might actually experiment with a guest coming up, and it might be a familiar one to you. I got one in mind. I haven't talked to her yet, but you've heard from her before, so we'll see how it goes with the guest. Anyways, that's happening, and a few other interesting people and places and things will be discussed on the show very shortly. Going to have to get back in touch with Glenn Vikeland. Still haven't done that. Going to bring him on because he thinks I've set him up on a show. We have future shows planned with Larry Hancock. Mike Swanson will be back next week. Jack Blood is scheduled to return. Although, if you didn't get your t-shirts from him yet. If you were supposed to and you made a donation, recontact him at that email address. Please, because he lost access to the people that were supposed to get the t-shirts, so do that. Anyway, all that is happening, and there is going to be a new direction out of the network, and hopefully we'll see a little more support come in, and some new topics, as well as some old friends coming back. Let's see, who did I hear from? One of the deans recently contacted me. Let me take a look. It was not the guy who writes about 9/11, though. It's a more popular author named Dean contacted me not too long ago. I'm trying to take a look at my notes, and, of course, my computer's freezing on me. So it is what it is. anyways, we'll be talking to him again shortly. He writes in a recent book about the elite bloodlines again. So I know that that's going to be of interest. We will also have a visit from Carmine Savastano coming up in the next couple of weeks. I might try to drag Maria Heller onto my show one time just to see what happens. Okay. But yikes. All right. Anyway, I'm really struggling to bring up my notes, so screw it. Off the top of my head. Yeah, so look, the news is what it is. The political strife is going to be what it is, and the sock puppet theater that is happening, monkey sock puppet theater, actually. Everybody's a monkey in my eyes. In fact, I like to send the little dancing monkey out to people on Skype all the time. And it is what it is. I really do want to do this thing for Lancer this year coming up in November. I'm thinking that maybe people will travel a little and come and get together. 60th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. These are the things I'm working on. In addition to some other material that's going to come out, mostly for free. We're trying to figure out what's going to go in the member section, what's going to go here and there and everywhere as we go forward. And the curating of the BitChute channel, I think I'll put a link in the show notes today. I want you guys to start going over there. Ray from Down Under has been working really hard on reestablishing a video presence for the network and my show over on BitChute. So who knows if that'll last or if I'll get deplatformed from there. What the hell? We're going to go forward as long as we can. And hopefully you, that's you, the listener out there, will be along for that ride. Because I think it's going to be an interesting one. This year, 2023, Jack was talking about how he thinks that there will be a new introduction of a biological effort to scare the hell out of everybody and maybe kill some of us in the process. Other people are talking about the great political strife, which is going to take place here in the United States. Hey, you know what? Are we getting closer to the new Civil War? In order for there to be a civil war, I mean, I believe war is a constant, but civility is yet another issue. Anyway, a new civil war, I don't go with that. I don't go with the predictions about the great biological, because I think at all times we are already in the crosshairs of a panopticon of weaponry that is chemical, that is biological, that is psychological, and that is the total of the creature that you're inhabiting, you know, that vehicle you're using for your journey on this three-dimensional planet and all, your journey as a spiritual being in your flesh suit or whatever it is you want to call it. Yeah, all of that is under attack, sure. And oh, by the way, the greatest thing that is really going to suppress people even further this year, that is going to suppress, oppress, and absolutely just press everybody, is the financial collapse, construct, crush that is going on. Now, is it going to be obvious and observable and, oh my, like the way they did it in the run-up to 1930, as we run up at this point almost 100 years later to the same time period? We didn't have World War I. We had the War on Terror. Not as effective at killing off populace. Not at all. So, you know, you got to play catch up there if you're an elitist playing the great game. And I think these people got bored with holding us in place. Wars were not as easy to, you know, create and propagate. So I think they have actually turned to doing exactly what somebody described not too long ago as, well, a bored child once they have everything they want to play with. And they've got all the money they need and there's nothing else for them to go after. Well, maybe they start looking for living things to torture, because that's at least some level of entertainment. So their level of entertainment is absolutely beginning with just taking out the magnifying glass and trying to burn us like ants with the financial crush. This is why you've been encouraged to be absolutely dependent. This is why you've been encouraged to sit and wait while things are delivered to you, wherever it is you're sitting, and make them available for you to be able to purchase them. Indeed, this is part of the paradigm, this is part of the plan, and that is what I see amping up in 2023. I think that they're going to continue to crush us with that, and you don't need to collapse the dollar if the entire game of trading these alleged slips of credit one way or another, bunches of IOUs, serial number tossing one way or another, and the great computers, because, you know, cashless society's coming, already here. You know, everybody's dealing with digital something or other, and all they got to do is flip a switch and kill that off. But that's too easy. Why not slowly suffocate people like a good constrictor does? Only when they breathe out do you tighten your grip. And then they can't breathe in again, so they attempt to breathe out. And over a short period of time, before anybody knows it, the sweet release of death is upon you. Yeah, I think that's the game. In the meantime, they're going to give us plenty of sock monkey puppet theater to, you know, pay attention to. By the way, this politician's your savior, this politician's your enemy. Wait a minute. You're from the other side of the table. Okay, look, that guy's actually your enemy, and that guy is actually your savior. Don't you worry. These billionaires care about you. these other psychopaths one way or another that have all sorts of resources at their fingertips to the point where they're bored with it, they are worried about your daily struggle. Are they going to continue to play the game of race and, hey, let's play girls against the boys? That was a childish game that used to be on the playground when I was a kid. But let's do that, and also let's confuse who's a boy and who's a girl. Oops, did I go there? I did. Those games are all going to get amped up. It's going to get amped up. I mean, they're going to turn it up. It's going to get hotter. The boiling frog thing is not entertaining to watch. So now we got to see what happens when you throw a live creature into a frying pan. So financially, I think they're going to continue to crush us very effectively. And everybody's going to point fingers at almost everybody else except the constrictor that's actually wrapped around them. I think that's what we're doing. I think it's going to be about servitude, slavery, and the savior system. One way or another, you're supposed to make yourself indentured to an idealism that had nothing to do with your core beliefs and actually contradict and make you a grand hypocrite. That's the encouragement. Why bother to make the effort to murder masses of people when you can just effectively do the things that make them kill themselves? And you can sit back and amuse yourself. Yeah, that's where we're going. But don't worry, it'll all change in 2024 when we reselect a selected somebody for middle management. Don't worry, we'll get somebody new into office over here. There'll be a speaker. There'll be a new president. There'll be a new whatever. It'll change everything, don't you worry. And by the way, Elon Musk is going to help you out along the path because there's a billionaire who cares about you too. And even without the billions, just because they have the privilege, just because they have the complexion and the connection for the connection. And you don't. They're going to play that game too. So in order to maintain and in order to assure themselves and us that there is always somebody to point a finger at, to demonize, to look down upon because they are further down the ladder. You know, nobody's actually poor. Nobody even thinks of themselves as poor because they think eventually they still have this delusion, this daydream of Americana. You can always move up the ladder. You can always be whatever it is you want to be. Tomorrow you can wake up and decide that you are neither a man or a woman, and that's okay. Tomorrow you can wake up and decide that you're a rich person, and that's okay. And tomorrow you can wake up and you can do anything you want to anybody else because you've now acquired the riches to be able to purchase your selective enforcement. It's all okay, and it's going to get better, and don't you worry, because whether it's this guy who has benefited from the system his whole life, or this other guy who's benefited from the system his whole life, or, wait a minute, you're supposed to identify with women, empower them. They're just as bad as the men, but no, it'll change things. And oh, by the way, if we make them look a little more like you, or if we make them have a similar skin tone or accent, you're going to do better. Because they're one of you, don't you know? You're supposed to identify. You're supposed to identify with the identity politics. I think that is going to be so solidified in the next 2 years. It's going to be an amazing transformation, where people that were once sleepwalkers might as well now be statues. And it's going to be the majority of the people around you. Now, because you take the time to listen to this show and put up with me ranting and talking, which I can't even do, you might think outside of the prescribed. I hope you do. And I hope you continue to thrive. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. I appreciate any contribution that you make over at Ocelli.com. I appreciate the emails, which I got to catch up on, and everything else. I really am just grateful that anybody puts up with me at this point. Because what is the madman in the craziest of worlds? Maybe he's sane. Maybe. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.